Hi, my name is Mark Netter. some people from my class are here. I'm an instructor in entertainment business. I teach entertainment marketing. This is literally the last week of my first time teaching here, first term, first class. It's been a great class. And one of the things I wanted to do, because I've worked in the entertainment business and in entertainment marketing, is to bring, if I can, to bring speakers here. And since so many of the students that were in my class were really interested in music, whether it's music marketing, marketing their own music, working for other people marketing music, I thought there was nobody better to bring than my friend Peter Rafelson. And so without any further ado, Peter Rafelson. So, Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about... I'm going to take it back. I'm going to start by taking it back. You've been in the music business for how many years now, would you say?
Too many.
Too many years, okay.
I actually really started when I was about 17, which was 1967.
Well, let's take it back first. Where were you born originally, and how did you end up in Los Angeles?
So... born in New York, in Manhattan, actually, and was born into a family that had some ties already to the industry. My great
to the music industry or the movie industry?
So my great uncle was Samson Rafelson, and he wrote the first film that ever had sound. It was called The Jazz Singer, and it was really, you know, Al Jolson in blackface. It was like old school, crazy Hollywood, early type movies, right? Years later, he was teaching at Columbia, and there was a student there by the name of Bert Schneider who pursued my father to come and become partners out in Hollywood, and they created TV shows like The Monkees, and The Greatest Show on Earth, and these are all just classic shows. I don't know if you guys... Does anybody know who The Monkees were? Okay, everybody over a certain age does. Well, right.
Just as a little background, The Monkees were basically a band that was put together for the TV show.
It was basically the America's answer to the Beatles, right? They'd seen A Hard Day's Night, which was the Beatles' first film, and said, let's do this in America. And so they created a show and cast the band, right? But they also created the first music video. This was the first time that there was, each episode had two songs that were cut as videos, not just part of the show.
Was this like 1969 we're talking about?
Best episodic won the Emmy in, I want to say, 68. And best comedy. Anyway, that was kind of the beginning of a whole new era. So my parents moved here when I was only 1 year old, and I kind of grew up in the center of Hollywood. And by the time movies like Easy Rider came out, my father was a producer of a bunch of these movies with Jack Nicholson, who's like a godfather to me. And they really were hailed as sort of like the early renegades of the independent film revolution. And that changed the course of every movie that we know. You know, there'd never been weed smoked on a screen. There was always people like Pillow Talk and all these very, very conservative movies, studio films. Easy Rider was the first one. I was kind of born into an independent spirit. They call it renegade or maverick spirit of this industry. And that gave me a little bit of a head start, because it gave me a chance to pursue something that most people might not have had even a chance to do, let alone any idea how to do it. And that was to pursue being, you know, I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to get laid in high school. I wanted to be like all that fun stuff that I saw on TV. But the difference was what I was seeing on TV was these monkeys in this band, and I was also seeing them in my living room. So I didn't really separate the two. I just saw that whatever that rock star life was, it was right in my home. and I could pursue it. So at a very, very early age, I knew what I wanted to do, and I was given an opportunity. Even in high school, I was already pursuing that. By the time I got out of high school, I had already started music school. I was dyslexic. I couldn't read shit. Honestly, I faked my way through it all, and I got really good at writing and producing tracks. And back in those days, remember, it wasn't like you had a computer. You had to get into a studio. You had to actually get access to, just to record. There was no phone, no computer, no... I mean, you know, the cheapest studio around was a $6 million enterprise. Like, literally, this was like Paramount, Warner Brothers, you know, Universal. Those are the people that own the studios. So that's kind of how I first started. And
what was your first instrument?
So when the Monkees broke up in 1968, my father and mother were in Cannes Film Festival accepting an award for Best Golden Palm Award. And the big old van drives up to the house, and this work guy gets out in his suspenders. He's like, "Where should we put these Monkees instruments?" And I'm like, I'm 7, 8 years old. I'm like, "Let's put them in my basement," right? So I snuck all this shit into my basement and taught myself how to play drums first. I'd been taking piano, horrible at it, couldn't read a note, was not fun, lessons. Then I got drums, guitar, bass, keys, and just figured out how to do all this stuff on my own. And that really gave me, that was probably the best head start I had, was I had a chance to actually touch instruments at an early age and teach myself with nobody knowing. It was like a secret that I got the stuff into the basement, how to play.
And then you did some music school?
I did. I simultaneously was kind of, you know, I had a decent grade average, but I didn't really want to pursue going to college. Yet, I wanted to prove that it was a choice. So I applied to all the colleges, Oberlin, Berkeley, and all the great schools. And I got in, and then I decided I wasn't going to go. Just to say, hey, it wasn't because I couldn't get in. It was a choice I was making. And that really gave me another head start, because by the time I was young for my school class grades, so by the time I was 17, I was already pursuing a vocation, a skill, a craft. Right. And one thing I would tell everybody in this room is, you know, there's this theory that 10,000 hours is what it takes to master anything. Man, I started my 10,000 early because I didn't want to be old and still trying to master something. I got my head start, and that is something I cannot tell you. While you all are still young, jump on that mastery, because it goes a long way once you get through those 10,000 hours. You a master. If you're a master by age 20, damn, that's a real head start.
And so when did you actually start songwriting?
You know, it's interesting, because I by the time I was out of high school, I'd already been playing in some bands. Funny stories. I'd started actually writing and recording myself on like the most rudimentary stuff, 2-track, right? Cassettes and 2-tracks. Yep. Tascams and Kiox and that kind of thing. And I did have a chance to start playing along with records, vinyl, and learning songs. And one other thing is that growing up in and around that whole Monkees TV show, people might not realize this now, but that show had the best songwriters, the best film resource, studios resources that you couldn't buy. Carole King, Jerry Goff, and Neil Diamond, Bobby Boyce and Hart. These were like the top songwriters in the world writing for the show. I grew up hearing the best songwriters work, right? So it was kind of, I guess, exposed to me at an early age, and that also helped me to study and understand what writing a great song was. You know, there's a difference between a great song and a great record. It's easy to make a banging record, guys. Maybe not easy, but just because it's a banging record doesn't mean it's a hit song. I'll give you an example. Party Rockers, you know, LMFAO, right? Great record. Is it a great song? I don't know. Hard to say. Try playing it on acoustic guitar when you're alone in the desert and tell me how it's going to sound. You know, it's a whole different vibe. Whereas a great song can be performed in any genre, and that craft was big importance to me.
You know, it's funny. I remember listening to Tori Amos's version of Smells Like Teen Spirit, which she plays on piano, and it's fantastic. So didn't necessarily have to be hard rock and guitar. It can be like a tinkly piano number and still is a great song, great songwriting. So you start, you're 17, you're starting your career, and you're in some bands, you're writing music. What was the journey to your first big break?
So I played the coming of age club that every rock band will tell you is sort of a turning point, and it was the Troubadour. Troubadour, is anybody familiar with the Troubadour nightclub? Yeah. So you'll see, even in the Elton John movie, biopics, and this is like a iconic spot in town. For me, it was a little bit different because I was underage, and, you know, you have to sneak in. If they serve alcohol, you're allowed to play, but you can't hang. So I go on stage with my band, Ray Love was the name of the band, and the drummer's girlfriend has been brought in to sing leads, her and her girlfriend, and they're pounding Jack, and I'm about to go on stage, and as we're heading up to the stage, they faint. And I looked down on the two girls. They were pounding Jack, and they fainted when the bright lights, it was hot as hell up there. And I remember looking down, and I'm looking at the audience, and I'm thinking, what just happened? And I'm like, okay, you know what? Fuck this. I'm going to go on with the show. I step over their bodies, go right up to the mic, start playing the one song that I get to sing. And, of course, that's done, and the show's over. And I'm now, you know, back out in the alleyway afterwards, and I remember there's like vomit on the fucking ground, and there's this place stinks, and I'm lifting all my heavy amps, and I'm thinking, I don't really want my future to be dependent on or ruined by somebody else's screw up. So the next morning, I went down to Guitar Center and I bought the first monophonic synthesizer ever made. It was a Pro One, and it connected through voltage control to a little step sequencer. This is long before computers and MIDI. And you literally got to count how many steps. If you want a note that goes, you know, bum, 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 you got to go like bum, space, 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 da, da, space, da, space, da, da, da. And literally you've sequenced it by counting how many steps. It's called a step sequencer, right? Turns out I wrote the first song with that thing called Blinded by the Boogie, and Rufus winds up cutting the thing. And on my 21st birthday, it was my 18th birthday, I got a call saying that I got a cut. And instantly I was like off to the races. Now, it took a minute, but that was the first time I actually realized that I could create something that got to market.
How did it get to Rufus, by the way?
Okay, well, a girlfriend from high school who wound up dating my dad was best friends.
Only in Hollywood, folks. Yeah. Only in Hollywood.
Best friend. She became friends with the keyboard player of Rufus, who wrote Ain't Nobody. And, he had me come up to the house. And that actually kicked off a huge career because there were epic producers and incredible jazz artists who were now cutting in mainstream, like George Duke, right? Nile Rodgers, people like that. All kinds of folks that were cutting these R&B records. But I was the first guy with that technology, and I could play my funky ass off on guitar, but I could also lay down the bass and the drums and the TR-808. And suddenly I'm making these whole tracks for these people, and eventually I started getting my own songs on Sister Sledge, the Pointer Sisters. That led to Fleetwood Mac, Elton John, Stevie Wonder, and it just blew up, 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 up in there.
So along the way, you know, it sounds like things were going pretty smoothly. Were there any particular struggles along the way or things that you had to overcome to get those songs on there to keep building? Was there a point where you felt like you had plateaued and needed to go further?
All of the above. You know, it's interesting because once I started laying down a lot of tracks on these instruments, this was a time when major record companies would pay for studio sessions. And in order to do those sessions, you had to join the Musicians Union, which I'm still a member of. But for a minute there, because I was able to between the technology and the musicianship and just kind of my know-how, I had people skills, I could hang. I became a session leader, and that meant that not only was I getting double session, triple scale, but I was also getting extra money to run the sessions and bring in some other folks from, you know, union players as well. Dude, 1980, you making $3,000-$4,000 a day just recording for songs and people? That was huge, man. I couldn't believe how this was going. At the same time, I wanted to be an artist, and I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a producer myself, because I knew I could do it, but I didn't necessarily control any of the money or the means of production. So I was still working for the man, whoever that was at the time, and loving it, but also thinking, how do I want to do what they're doing. I don't want to be working for them. I want to be calling the shots myself. And this is something that we all deal with, and it's a really interesting problem to have, which is, do I do the practical thing that pays the bills and is hard to say no to money or a job or working for somebody, or do I sacrifice it and risk, you know, being homeless and following my dreams of being, you know, my own boss? And everybody who hasn't had to question that in this room, is there anyone who hasn't thought about which way to go on that? Because I can tell you right now, it haunts you. And if you're going to be successful, every one of you will have to make your own decision. Do I do something that's safe, or do I take that risk and do something that matters, that has impact? I pray for all of you that you can do both, because somebody got to pay the bills while we follow our dreams. And if it ain't daddy or mommy, you got to figure out how to balance that. But it is truly a combination of both sides that you learn to balance.
So you told me a story one time about one of your biggest hits, maybe the biggest?
By far.
So there's a song, I'm just checking if everybody here knows, so they know it's a little while back, by Madonna, called Open Your Heart. Is everybody pretty aware about that song? Yeah, anyone not? A huge top charting hit, you can probably tell me more about it. But you told me a very interesting story about how Madonna ended up buying that song from you and then collaborating on that song.
Well, buying is not the right word, because you don't buy a song, you get it cut. If it's a bought song, then it's called work for hire, and usually you will write it. But here's how the story goes. So at this point, I'd had some success. I was still living in my dad's garage. But I knew that it wasn't just luck at this point. I was on to something. And at that point, I'd built up a little bit more equipment, still no recording, but I got what was called an Oberheim system, which was a drum machine and a sequencer that all sunk together and could actually program a song enough to play it through in its entirety. So I write a song called Open Your Heart, and I want Cyndi Lauper to record it. She's the artist I thought of. She had had Time After Time and Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Thought she was maybe one of the more interesting artists at the time. And as I'm working on the song, a car breaks down outside my studio, and the guy that gets out of the car comes, knocks on my garage door and says, you know, can you help me? And I said, well, I don't know what, you know, what, who are you and what are you doing? He's like, I'm selling typewriters and my car just broke down. Can I use your phone? He comes in and he sees what I'm doing. He's like, what's going on? I said, well, this is a song. I'm a musician. I'm writing this for Cyndi Lauper. And he's like, well, I can help you get it to Cyndi. And I said, what? What do you talk about, Willis?
So random, right?
So he's like, the guy that I'm staying with, I'm a musician too. Okay, great. Like, not another one of us, right? Is friends with the industry, and he you know, I said, listen, if you can get this song to Cyndi and she cuts it, you know, I'll let you be a writer on it. I'll make you a writer on the damn thing. That would be awesome. Well, he didn't. He couldn't. But what he could do was get me into one of the earliest home recording studios, where over the course of a year, I was able to sneak in and one night at a time, every four weeks, cut the demo. And when I finished the demo, I was leaving the studio and it was a reel-to-reel sitting in the lobby, and I had my little cassette of my song. And like, what's going on with the reel-to-reel? And the guys who worked at the studio said, oh, that's going off to a big label. There's a new artist that, you know, management is asked for songs, and we've put together our writers. And I'm like, dude, if you don't put my song on there, I will never speak to you again. And they didn't. And in fact, they were kind of shitty to me. And they're like, why would we, you know, want to do that for you? Well, I knew that tape was going somewhere that I couldn't get to. Now, you got to remember, this is an era when the only way to be heard is when you physically get your music on some medium. There's no sending emails.
No digital.
Nothing. That night, I put on a ski mask. And I took my Walkman and I broke back into that studio and I recorded a copy of my song onto that reel-to-reel tape. And
at the end of the tape, right?
It's the last song on the tape, and I didn't write nothing on that box. So I leave, and man, a week later goes by, nobody knows, and I'm like, shoot. Those writers of the other four songs on the tape start bragging that they got a cut on a Madonna record. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I am bummed out. I'm back to zero. I risked it all. Nothing happened. Another month goes by, and another friend comes by, and he's got a cassette. He's like, this is a bootleg of the new Madonna record that I just was at a session and they were working on her new song. And before I could stop him, he plops in the tape and pushes play, and it's my freaking song. And I'm like, oh my God, what just happened? They chose the last song on the tape and told the writers. The writers didn't know there was a secret fifth song on the tape. They're bragging that they got the cut, and nobody knows except me. And I kept my mouth shut. It was the hardest thing I ever did, not to tell a soul. I'm seeing Madonna, Sean Penn. I'm at the nightclub. I'm seeing all the Warners people. I'm all over town thinking nobody knows. I'm a criminal, and I'm on one of the biggest records of all time. And I can't say a word. I wait until I hear that the vinyl has shipped 600,000 pieces. It is shipping gold. I'm on a gold record and nobody knows it. I call up the lawyer. I say, listen, this may come as a shock to you, but that song, Open Your Heart, is mine. I wrote that. And he's like, don't even try it. This is fraud. You'll be sued. We're not hearing anybody's claims about what they didn't write. And I said, okay, well, then just tell me this. why is this me singing the original demo? And I held up the cassette that I'd recorded to the phone, and I played it for him, and I let it get to the chorus. Open your heart to me, baby. Stop. And I said, yeah? And he's like, I'll call you right back. The phone rings, and he says, say this is your song. If you don't give up all your rights, it's never going to see the light of day. It won't go on any album. I'm thinking, it's on 600 motherfucking records already, so don't say that. He doesn't know what's up. I knew. So I called his bluff, and I said, no problem. Take it off. And he's like, huh? I said, no, that's cool. I'm fine with that. I'm not giving up the rights to my song. Take it off the album. Well, they couldn't take it off. It was too late. And the song shipped on that first 600,000 units. It got to the labels where they add the label to the vinyl, right? It's two separate processes back then. And the first 600,000 albums didn't know how to spell my name right, didn't have any information right. So it said P. Ralphelson. And I love that. That's the gold album that I hang on my wall, because it was, even though it went on to sell 9 million, 10 million, 20 million, 30 million records, those first ones where they misspelled my name proves my story. And that to me was the best story.
So the lesson for everybody here is don't do anything illegal. But it
sure worked for me.
Yeah, don't do as I do.
Hunter Thompson once said, drugs, violence, and guns, I don't condone them, but they sure worked for me.
All right, so you've got this song now that's a hit single.
Massive hit. I'm on top of the world, and I'm sleeping on it. Stupid. I'm not... I could have went... Everybody want a piece of me, and I'm like... living high on the hog. I'm getting mailbox money. I bought a home for cash. I'm loving life. I'm doing shit that nobody should be doing. And you know, granted, I'm still working. I'm still getting songs. But it's coming to me. I'm not out there pursuing it.
You're like 24 years old, probably.
26 at this point. Yeah. And honestly, guys, it's the one regret I do have. And I don't really have a lot of regrets, but I do regret not being more proactive when I could have done anything. And I wasn't that I was lazy, because I loved working, but I was comfortable. And I learned that comfort is the enemy of action.
So your advice to, if anyone here is lucky enough to have success, whether it's massive success or even, you know, something that makes you feel comfortable, they minor success along the way, any kind of benchmark that you hit, you get the great job, you whatever it is.
Use it and go right on to the next level, as high as you can go. Go, go, go. When you get to the end zone and you cross that end zone, get your ass back to the 50 and get over that end zone again. Do not sleep on that stuff. It's your chance to excel. And I got back up there a number of times. I've had 30 number one records in one way or another, but it took me a long time. That first moment where I had written 100 songs that year, and 3 of them made it to the top 10. There was a Stevie Nicks song. There was a Journey song. There was a Madonna song. And, you know, that was a lot of writing to do. Every day I was with a different writer in a new situation, hustling. And it paid off. But the next year I probably wrote 50, or the next year I wrote 10 or 15 or 20. And just by sheer numbers and statistically, it was not going to continue at that rate.
Now, at one point, as I recall, you did do work in-house at Warner Brothers Records and EMI. Is that correct?
Those were two separate jobs. I did eventually get a staff producer gig. Warner Brothers Records was in the late 80s. And then after that, I had been working at home so much, I finally went out and built some studios where I could, you know, get a little separation between work and home. That's something that, again, is a real tough call, guys. You know, it's you go to work and you're a little bit more motivated to do something. You're at home, you get more time to work, but you can jump in the pool or sleep in or do stuff that might not necessarily push you as hard. So I started building studios, and one of the people that I partnered with was an executive, and he hired me at EMI, Virgin EMI. And that was a great experience because it was the only time that I actually had any kind of corporate environment. And I wasn't really there much, but I had a card, and it had, you know, my name on it as Virgin EMI, and it was a thrill.
So what was the Warner's job like? Was it a short term, or what were the duties like being a producer over there?
Well, it's interesting. Warner's is something that keeps coming back to me, and I don't know why that is, except that some of the biggest early hits I had, including Rufus and Chaka Khan and Sister Sledge and Atlantic and Madonna, obviously, and then Stevie Nicks, these are all Warner. So they kind of knew me well enough that when it came time to do a remake of the Monkees show called The New Monkees, they're like, this is our guy. He's connected to the original show. He's got all these number ones. So I started working at the Burbank offices, and some of the biggest executives of all time, Mo Austin, Lenny Waronker, Russ Titelman. And here's something even more ironic. Years later, I wound up taking over what was the Warner Brothers lot, Warner Brothers Records lot. So now I'm the head honcho of my own domain, where Paul Simon, Aretha Franklin, Frank Sinatra, the Doobie Brothers, Van Halen, like, recorded all of those great albums for Warner Brothers. And that was kind of intense because that's inspiring to be in those.
So when you're a staff producer at Warner Brothers, are you basically being given assignments as to what to produce? Are you supposed to bring in the work yourself? How does it work? Or how did it work back then? It may be different now.
So Warner's is an interesting company. They've always had sort of a committee. They've also been one of the few majors that ever really invested in development. Most studios and labels don't develop. That's our job. We're the guys that are supposed to find the artist or find the song or build the track or do the homework or put up the social media and get our numbers and get on YouTube and show that there's a following and show that can build an audience, and then they'll step in. Warner's was great because they would sign what were called development deals. Ain't nothing like that anymore. But the beauty of working at that company was that you could be funded to develop your craft or your work or your art. And then they would choose to go to singles, and then they would choose to go to albums. The tough part was that there was 30 or 40 people in that A&R process that would meet once a week or once a month, and they'd all review together. So they called it making records by committee. So there was the benefit was you got a chance, but to get past that gatekeeper took about 30 ears to agree. Yeah.
And could anybody just blackball somebody and kill it? Or
good, great question. I was in one or two of those meetings, and at one point somebody goes, "What's he doing here?" I'm a producer, right? But it was fascinating, and if enough people can agree what's a hit, is it a hit? I don't know. But I can tell you that they can't all be wrong, and they made some incredible records with some incredible artists who to this day are not just epic in their own right, but you hear artists that we've respected for years later all referring back to Joni Mitchell would be a great example. Some of the greatest writers and artists of all time came out of that.
So I want to move on to another sort of stage in your career, but I have a couple last questions about that period and the period before. So one of the things that my students were doing in entertainment marketing is how you market yourself or how you market an artist. But back then, so you have to market yourself as a songwriter, essentially, to be able to sell your songs. Was that all relationship-based, or how did you kind of market yourself at that time?
You really didn't. And that whole term of being able to market yourself, or you're a brand, everybody's talking, you know, hey, man, think of yourself as a brand now, and you got to build your name. That didn't happen. That's what the best feature, the best reason, the best use of, the best justification for signing a deal was, because promotions is something that labels would do. Publicity is something that labels would do. And when you negotiated as a writer or as a producer, you could negotiate that when in print, when Billboard magazine announces Madonna's new single, it's going to say, it has to say contractually, written by and produced by, and there were credits. Y'all know what credits is? Because I haven't seen any in a hell of time. So credits was something that mattered. Now the credits is, hey, I just jumped on a Tyga track, hashtag yo, check me out. Like, that's a credit. Really? Okay. I don't know how official that is, because a lot of people hashtagging a lot of BS out there, but at least you got a chance to market yourself. You can also say anything you want and do anything you want. Hey, did you all know that I'm God and I just produced every hit record ever made? Hashtag, it's true.
Okay, now, so at that point, you're in the stream of the music business. You're writing songs, you're producing, you're working with, I mean, the list of the people, kind of crazy list over here of some of the artists you've worked with.
And getting credits, and those credits are listed. You know, remember, internet wasn't around yet, but the cool thing was, every single person I ever met had at least one album with my name. And I could literally go and say, oh, hi, my name is. And I could say, hey, are you a fan of? Oh, hell yeah. I said, well, go check it out. And they could literally pick up something that they owned, and my name was on it. That was cool.
Now, as things went on, you became more and more interested in music rights and in management. Is that correct?
Okay, so I got a number one song. I got no publisher. I got no deal. I that song exploded, and I was the first writer to have no publishing deal and to have a number one song in Billboard, and ain't no company involved except for me. Careful what y'all wish for, because here's what happens. Damn, this is so good. Peter, why don't you go and sign a publishing deal? Now that you're a big record, you know, writer, and you're a hit writer, somebody's got to look after your business. And I was like, hold up. Ain't nobody was looking after it when I got my number one, so why do I need to do that? And every time I was told what the norm was, it wasn't that I was against the man and I was going to, like, try to do... No, all I was doing was questioning, why can't I do that myself? Is it that I'm not able to, or that I don't want to? Which is it? Why am I doing this? Is it because I'm not capable of handling my own? So I started building and just literally going up every obstacle. No one had done this. Certainly in 1986... there were two awards given by ASCAP, the Writer of the Year and the Publisher of the Year, and I won both of those awards. It was myself as Rafelson on the writer, and publishing award goes to Peter Rafelson on behalf of Rafelson Music and Madonna on behalf of Warner Brothers, Warner Chapel Music. So now I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a real thrill. This is like something that hadn't happened before. A kid can make a record and own his own publishing, and now I got him on the shop. Now I got to figure out how the hell do I collect? Like, this is a big world, and you can't just, you know, hi, can you please send me my checks? It doesn't work that way. So I was literally creating the structures and the business that all the majors were using, but I had to do it myself. Now, I did have one advantage. Maybe I was smart. Maybe I didn't like no for an answer, but I also was always on the cutting edge of technology, and I learned how to use the internet before it was called the internet. DARPA was the defense systems for nuclear freaking Holocaust. I was on it. CompuServe was the first time there was a network. I was on it. AOL was the first. The Macintosh comes out. I got the sixth one ever made. Every step of the way, I was like looking to see what tools can I use to give me an advantage over Warner Brothers. Like, I'm competing with Warner's, really? It's really important, guys. Don't sleep. Don't sleep. Period. On anything. On anything. Unless you just want to let the other guy go right ahead. It's like the hare in the
tortoise
in the hare.
So would you say that even today, that whole being able to get ahead on technology is a way to get an edge if you're an artist out there?
You know, it's a great question, Mark, because the truth is, you know, there was a saying that Smith and Wesson leveled the playing field, right? God made man, but the 45 made man equal. Okay, technology today is an equalizer in the sense that is there anybody in this room that doesn't own a smartphone? That smartphone that you're holding is 1,000 times more powerful than the computers that I was using to give me the edge. So we are now all faced with what is it that we can use for an advantage? And it's not necessarily technology, but the beauty of it is how to use that technology. Now you can come up with an idea for an app or an idea of how to organize your own life or an idea of how to manage your own time. And literally, y'all have those tools. But also look for new tools because there's smart people making stuff every day. I love discovering new tools, and whether I'm hacking them or advising to these companies, I love seeing what's out there. And the beauty is, if you get involved in technology, it may be great, it may not be, but guess what? You got your finger on the pulse, and you can always see, you can predict the future, you can see where things are going. Luckily for me, I had all these rights and this management and this need for distribution and collections and how to manage your own rights. Now everybody got their own rights. That's no surprise. Man, we ain't giving it away. We all artists, why would we sign that away when we can do it ourselves? And, you know, CD Baby or whatever the hell else is out there for distribution, it's all doable from your phone. You can damn near make a record on your phone and have it in a million countries without ever leaving your seat. But how are you doing it versus somebody else? I love learning from young kids what the next game is, what the next platform is, what the next app is. And the second anybody my age knows about it is dead. You know, I Facebook was long gone before 50-year-olds picked up on it. Instagram is history at this point. I mean, it's still real popular, but I know a secret that all the young kids are using right now, and it's 4 years old, and I'm just finding out about it. Can anybody tell me what, and I ain't talking about TikTok and Snapchat. There's a new way that kids are being discovered, and they've got their whole own economy right now through this app. Can anybody here guess what it is and name it? What is it? Nope. That's crypto, which is another discussion we'll have. This is an app for promoting and being discovered and getting fans and getting tokens.
And it works.
Oh, it's been working for 4 years. Nope, all old. Y'all tired. Nope. TikTok did help put Old Town Road to number one. Okay, I'll credit them. It's a little app called Live.me, and this shit is crazy popular among 10-year-olds, 15-year-olds. They're making money with this.
How many people out here know Live.me? 2, 3, 4. Do you guys use it? Why do you?
I'm not 10 years old.
Okay, but is it really 10 years old people are using?
Like, it's been around for
4 years.
4 years or so.
But. All right, well, I can only tell you that I don't know what results you're looking for if you're a 40-year-old on a platform full of 10-year-olds, but I'll tell you what results I'm looking for is how are kids building their brand. Talk about promoting oneself. This 14-year-old comes into my office the other day, and she's like, I got 40,000 fans, and I'm getting paid. I'm like, what? She's like, yeah, live.me, I'm getting paid. My fans are paying me. And I'm like, damn, you can't even monetize on Instagram. You can charge, you know, Snapple to take a picture if you got a million fans. But this is literally an economy of technology, which is, by the way, whoever said it, sort of where crypto's all going.
All right, so you have become now, you talked about somebody coming into your office, into your studio. You've built several studios. The one right now is in North Hollywood.
Yep.
And why don't you tell us a little bit about the studio?
So, you know, studios are like this virus that keeps on growing and growing. And remember that I came from an era where just getting into a studio was a huge barrier to entry. So having my own studios and being able to have the means of production before that was everywhere, was a huge part of my evolution. And eventually I couldn't help myself when I kept building and building. And finally I took over that studio that Warner's used to record at. And after 2003, I came home from lunch one day and the building was entirely chained closed and I couldn't even get in my own building. And I'm like, what's going on? And there was a notice on the door. This building is going to be leveled. We're building the North Hollywood subway right here and you can't even get into your own building to get your own briefcase out. Well, they overlooked me big time and that was a huge violation of what's called the NoHo relocation program. I was missed by the tenants and I was missed by the owners association and I literally got shut down. My whole life got shut down. It took me 18 months to sue and win $1 million against the city of Los Angeles. And with that, I went and bought the building that we're in now and built 10 more studios, but they were lean and mean. You know, ain't no need for everybody to have live drums in every room. So there's one big room, but the rest of them are really cool and sort of like modular and very, you know, modern structure. I looked at the way Max Martin and a chair on in Stockholm, and the way Hans Zimmer put his systems together. And they were a bunch of little rooms with very talented people, and the music could just go through each room, and one guy could do what he does best, drums, another guy could do vocals, another guy could do writing, another guy could do synths, guitars, and they come out with these incredible recordings that no one person could compete with factory.
And different people rent the different rooms for different periods of time. You get younger artists, older producers, people mixing for Lady Gaga, all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, that's the stuff that I've seen.
So eventually, I started hiring people to come in and work on my records, and I was able to scale up with that much space. And some people who were very revered and respected asked if they could stay when the job was done with me. And I was like, well, you know, I didn't have this in mind. I didn't build this to be a rental place. But considering you about to bring Lady Gaga and Beyonce and Taylor Swift and Ariana Grande into my building, you could stay. So Tony Maserati, who's one of the top mixers of, you know, of the game, maybe top five of all time. Grammys coming out of my building. I'm looking around. Hey, there's Little Blue, and there's Jay-Z and Mommy and Daddy. And I'm like, man, I remember there was a time where I couldn't get to nobody, and I was waiting in line just to try to get in the door. And now all these stars are coming through my door. So, you know, it's a lot to manage, guys, but there's a thrill there. And again, how long do I keep that behemoth anchor around my neck? It's expensive to own that. And most people go, why? Well, we don't need no studio. Let's go into my apartment. Well, there's two sides to that coin. A place for people to convene, a place to be creative, place to collaborate, a place to sit on a nice couch, and some speakers and some gear too. Less and less, I got rid of the big stuff. But having that environment is inspiring, and it's still valuable.
And part and parcel of that seems to be that you get a lot of younger artists coming through there, some of which you are working to help their careers, managing, working with them on rights. Can you talk a little bit about how that works for you?
So, you know, when you have that much experience and that much space and that much resources, you realize that you can't just use it all yourself. So I started building more and more labels and publishing companies and developing artists. And it's really fun because now I'm kind of known as one of those guys who has big number one hits with these artists that I look at this thing, I can't even believe in myself. It's like, who's working with, you know, Ty Dolla and Elton John? Who, since when does Stevie Wonder record somebody else's song that he didn't write? These are my favorite writers, two of them in the best ever. And they recorded my song? Okay. But at the same time, I'm also working with complete unknowns. And I'm working with young kids and their parents. And I'm teaching them. And I'm inspiring them. And I'm a mentor. And I'm going to build up other people's careers. And the funny thing is, you know, some people have $1 million to fuck with. And I'm not always going to take it if I don't think that it's actually something I can create impact. I want to know that they're going to trust me, they're going to have some resources to bring to the table, but that they're going to also hold up their end of the bargain. Vanity projects are the killer of this business, and you just become the laughing stock, right? And people thought that's what I was doing until I was able to turn what they thought was a vanity project into a huge, huge career. Talking about a girl named Erica Jane, who some of you might know from Bravo Network.
The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
That would be her. And she came into my office 12 years ago, and I was like, this cannot be a vanity project. She's like, well, I'll trust you. I've got the money, but, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, so you take control. And I said, okay, but this is going to be a long-term relationship. And little by little, I built this career up. And to this day, she's got the most number ones as an independent artist on an independent label. We just hit 13 number ones on an unknown artist, every song that has come out. That's not luck.
So I'm going to do a few more questions, and I want to open it up to everybody out here. Do you have any particular advice for young artists or managers who would be in the audience here tonight as to how to distinguish themselves, how to break through?
So it's interesting, the words that we use, because I think everybody's an artist, and I think everybody's a manager. And the best managers are artists, and the best artists are managers. Because the when I say best, I don't necessarily mean the most talented. I'm talking about the most successful. Being successful requires a sense of what management is. Management, by contract, is offering legal guidance and advice. Now, in order to have the skill to offer guidance and advice, it means you better know something, right? You can't necessarily force people to do anything, but you can encourage them and share your wisdom and give them advice. Listen, if I were you, I wouldn't take this job. It's going to lower your brand value. If I were you, I'd wear nothing fancy and keep it real. Keep it down to earth. Keep that's what people love about you. Like, understand all those aspects of imaging, positioning, marketing, distribution, development, production, writing, publishing, royalties, accounting. There's so many things that are part of how you measure success. Hopefully, you'll, as an artist, know enough about it to be your best manager. And the challenge there is interesting, because, oh man, I want somebody else to manage me so I can do what I do best. I want to be a star. I want to be just in the studio writing my own shit and focusing on being an artist. Okay, cool. Well, then I'll just take all your checks and go to Mexico. You stay here and be an artist, and you can be homeless in 2 years. And that happens a lot.
I have a couple questions from someone who couldn't make it here, who's also a musician who's trying to make it out there. And I'm going to ask a couple of these. If you could go back in time, what would you tell your younger self?
I love this question. I think I've answered that already. I would tell my younger self, don't sleep. It's such a blessing to have an open door, an opportunity. There's so few things in this world that we actually have control over. And every decision that you are actually given, and it's a gift, is a chance to be a hero. So take that chance and be a hero.
I'm inspired. One of the other ones was, what's the biggest nuance that you think is being overlooked in marketing music? Does that make sense to you, that question?
The relationship with the fan. Because that is something that really is the answer to a question that nobody bothers asking. And this is important. I'm glad you asked this. I'll tell people, after impressing the hell out of them, I'll say, listen, you don't have to choose me. There's a hell of a lot of other people out there. But most producers, you know, are going to basically cut a record and hand you a CD or a piece of plastic or an MP3 and say, good luck. What happens next? So I always say, okay, that's great, because I can tell you what happens next. But there's a much more important question to ask. It's so easy to say, what music? where, studio, when, tomorrow night, who, the artist. But there's five W's. What's the fifth W? Yes. Yes. And it's the one question nobody asks. Why? Why am I doing any of this? Why am I spending money? Why am I actually making music? Why am I trying to get a hit? Why am I trying to get on the charts? Why am I trying to get on the radio? What's the actual end result? And it's really about creating a relationship with a fan. And the ultimate why is your purpose. You know, there's a great saying, the 2 days of your life that matter the most are the day you were born and the day you find your purpose. And that's the why.
I'm loving that. And the last question that I had, that was the last one I'll ask before opening it up, what major changes do you see the music industry making in the next decade, the next 10 years? Is there anything you can look ahead and see changes that we're not seeing yet?
Well, you know, artificial intelligence is something that is certainly on the rise, and I'm fascinated with and terrified by the fact that very few jobs will exist in advanced societies. When I say jobs, I mean like manual, anything that requires, you know, either intelligence and or some sort of service, right? People don't realize that truck driving is actually the most common business in America. It's the most common job.
And it's actually the best job, supposedly the best paying job you can get on average without a college education.
And within 5 years, there'll be none left. Literally. There's already, you know, everything is moving towards automated cars. But the thing, how this applies to the music industry is, man, there are actually apps now that will write a song for you, and they're all touting this as something that, you know, can be your friend. And meanwhile, I've tried them, and they're just horrible. I know that it will get better, and it'll be interesting. But one thing that is coming is going to be the advancement of, again, rights and of collection and of business and of transacting. And between crypto and technology and blockchain and the ability to actually control your own rights, well, people say that's great, but then they still say, but I'm still not making any money. So one thing I think is on the horizon is if you create intellectual property, you do, because if it's AI, there's a lot of questions as to who owns it and who makes money. Is it the guy that pressed go? Is it a computer's rights? Is it robots ever?
Programmer.
Everybody here who has a brain and some sense of intellect can create intellectual property. Soon there will be an opportunity for anybody who can create intellectual property to monetize it in ways never seen before. That's something super exciting. I'm pushing for that every day. The less other people get their fingers in my shit, the more I can keep and the more I can choose to share. I want to be able to say, I want to work with you because I want your mind. I want to collaborate, not because you're the guy that's going to register my Google ad account and collect for me on YouTube. Like, that's no reason to share, dude. That's like a pressing a button. It's sad that tech has created a new class of control gatekeepers, and those are the nerds and the programmers who know how to do stuff. I don't know how to do it all myself, but I know enough about it to know why I'm choosing somebody to do it with me. And I think that's something we all don't. I don't want to be a programmer. I want to play guitar. Okay, well, then you're either going to let somebody else handle it and you don't know what they're doing, or you're going to learn enough about it to either do it yourself or to make the right decisions.
All right, questions. Anybody out there have any questions for Peter here of stuff that we haven't covered or anything they want more to know more about? Yes, sir.
This is the question I always get. The question was, how does somebody get into working for me or into one of my studios? And it's funny because there was another amphitheater, I don't know if it was in one of these buildings, where I gave a big lecture. And at the end, all the kids asked this question. I said, everybody stand up. And everybody stood up. And everybody who knows how to use Pro Tools or graduated with the music and is an engineer or a producer or writer, take a step forward. Great. Everybody said, okay. And everybody who thinks that they're qualified to work at a studio, take a step back. And everybody takes a step back. I said, and now everybody that wants to work for me and can bring a paying client into my building and get me paid, take a step forward. And nobody took a step forward. So here is the lesson I'm going to give you. I don't care about Pro Tools. Y'all know how to do an edit. Y'all know how to take an iPhone thing and send it up to Vimeo and get your reel on and get your acting. Everybody's a freaking artist and a genius, okay? But what does any one of you bring to the table that's over and above what you're learning to do that makes you all the same? What do you do that wasn't taught here that maybe you're the only person that knows how to do this? And the way I measure that is make yourself indispensable. I can't get rid of your ass. I need you. You're doing something for me that nobody else can do. Thank you, dude. Come work for me. Keep whatever it is working. I'm getting something from you, and it ain't just because you know how to press Pro Tools better than he do. Like, that's basics. Those are basic requirements. When you read a job description and you say, hell yes, I can do that, man, there's 1,000 other people that can also do that. So when you write that intro letter or that cover letter, not only can I do everything in this job description, but I want you to know that the first week I work at your company, I'm going to increase your income because I figured out how to bring business to your table, and I want to take that business, but you're going to get paid too. I want the same thing you do. I want to get up. I want to move up. I want to get paid. Help me get paid. You got yourself a lifelong job.
Not sure how encouraging that is, but other questions? Yes, sir.
What is your creative process like when you're writing songs? Like, you know,
great question. So this is something I want to try to instill into everybody. Before there was talent and before there was a process, for millenniums, there were masters, mentors, students. What was Percival? He was the... Okay. The words that they used to...
Apprentice.
The manual arts, which was the craftsmanship. You know, they said Jesus was a craftsman. He could build cabinets. I've never had writer's block. Never. And the reason is because I learned a craft. The craft of songwriting was, what do I want to build? A cabinet maker doesn't have block. Hey, man, today I want to build a cabinet above my sink. Man, I'm not inspired. Like, dude, you know, what kind of cabinet you want to build? Cut the wood, make the measurements, see the thing, make the design, and build it. So that's my process. The one thing that I will say is learn how to do enough stuff so that It's just a decision you got to make. It's not about how am I going to be inspired. I got to get high and get groovy, and then let's go to the beach because we'll be, the waves will. Whoa, dude! If you need all that, you know, come on, man. Like, get good at something and figure out how to use it. The beauty of it, though, is my process changes every single time, depending on. And who I'm working with. I love, if you're a top liner but your lyrics ain't great, I can step in and write good lyrics. If you can write amazing lyrics but you don't got no sense of beats or production, I can step in and do that too. It's really, really a great feeling to have an unlimited set of skills. So that way, you always have options. When it comes to being inspired, you know, I still go back to this almost like psychic mentality of visualization. What is it that you want to leave your audience with? When you leave the theater, what should that film have made you feel? It's like that with songs too. Do I want a love song? Who am I hurting? Who am I helping? How clean do I want it to be? Is this something Christians are going to take offense to? Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I'll write a clean song. Is this something that's going to have some language on it? Is this something that's going to get me in trouble with the Me Too movement? Everything you can think of, it's a choice. It's not because you're stupid. It's because you intend to do something. And that intention is the intellectual property. So figure it out, and what you decide to do, see it, hear it, and then just executing, it's easy.
Okay, I know we're running a little bit late. One down here, and then there and there. So, Chantel.
How are you?
So I do know, I'm doing great.
Thank you.
I do know that you've done songwriting, song production, as well as sound scoring as well for films. I also want to talk about the whole film, your film career, because I did read that you ventured into acting as well. So how did you transition from music to acting?
It's never a transition, and it's thank you for asking that, because I don't like being known just as a songwriter or as a musician. I like being known as you can see, as an entrepreneur or I've directed and I've produced. And I don't mean music. I've acted in a number of films. That all helped me understand and develop those additional skills. You know, I was in one of the earliest movies called Fame. Fame, I want to live forever. That song, that movie. Yeah, I was in that movie. I played guitar on stage in New York in the band that was cast in that. So all of that experience, every one of those things, I wanted to make sure that it would be of some use or value to me. I'm super ambitious. If I just wanted to be a songwriter, I probably wouldn't have done all those different things. But I can't help myself. I think I'm a better songwriter because I learned how to be an actor. I think I'm a better leader and a better CEO because I've learned how to communicate and how to look somebody in the eye and answer their questions after listening to them. Every skill set has some value, and it doesn't limit to the one skill, right? The better listener you are, the better speaker you are, the better singer you are, the better producer you are. So to answer the question, and I hope this makes sense to you, I never stopped doing any of it. I still act. The last decent paying gig I just did, I was the narrator in an Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jackie Chan movie. And it's my voice for the first 5 minutes of the movie. Some crazy, big-ass Game of Thrones type, you know, action movie. And I got the job doing this voice.
Dark, dark beyond the third country, a
rose the great dragon. He came down to the people and his claws dug deep into the ground. And he helped heal the people who suffered.
And they couldn't believe it. Now, it's not my goal was not to be a voiceover actor, but my goal was to have command over different skills in my life. So transitioning, no, including and building into my portfolio of experiences and skills.
All right, Wayne back.
Great question, Louis V. I don't know if you all heard it, but he wanted to know, how do you put yourself in a position to be your own boss, your own masters, your own publishing? So first of all, if you can hum a note, you are your own publisher. End of story. The second you create anything, you are your own publisher. I think the question is, how do you get to the point where you can build a successful company doing that, right? Because there's everybody in here is a publisher. Everybody in here owns their own master. Have you ever recorded your outgoing message on your iPhone? That's a master, and you own it. You created that. How to monetize it? You know, it's really interesting because I'll tell you something funny. I gave up an awful lot of my rights early on, once or twice, and I was so happy to do it. I wound up bending over, and you can imagine the rest, and I wound up with 10% of the first hit song that I had out there. But it was cut by Julio Iglesias and Margaret and Laura Branigan, and it was an international hit, and it was so great to have something and the choice to give it away, right? Now, I'm now the opposite. You want to work with me? Guess what? You don't own shit. We're going to collaborate? I'm taking everything. Oh, that ain't fair. I'm going to pay your ass. I'm going to make sure we both get paid. You're going to get your fair share. You'll get your equal share, but it's going to be me paying you. Now, here's the typical question from somebody who doesn't understand this. Why should I give up everything to let you go and own it? And I said, okay, I'll tell you what. Let's just switch it around. I'm giving you everything we do here together. And now I want you to go and collect all my money from 180 countries around the world. I want you to get me paid. I want accounting. I want to be able to audit you. I want you to be responsible and accountable for the distribution, the publishing, and the collections. I want you to do all of my licensing, and I want you to go and get us all the cuts, and I want you to get us in every major television show and movie. And they look at me and they go, well, I don't do that. I don't do any of that. And I said, oh, well, then maybe you understand why I'm going to do it for us. Because if you could do that, I'd be more than happy to give you all those rights. Make yourself indispensable. If you can do that for me, Mr. V, what was your name? Louis V. V, you got my publishing if you want to do all the what I just said for me. Go figure that out. And come talk to me, man. I'll give you everything I got if you can. Because guess what? I can go and continue doing what I'm doing. And if you can do it too, I'll make twice the money. That's how you do it. You figure out how to get other people paid.
Yes, sir.
It's a great question. He's talking about ego. How do you balance? You know, ego is something that has very, very little value except to the person who has that ego. It's me believing in myself. But I'm so happy for you. You're confident. I'm so happy for you. You think you're the shit. What else? I'll give you that. You are the shit. Okay, let's just say you're the fucking the best there is. Now what are we going to do with it? You want me to call you the best? Will that help you? It's babysitting, bro. This is a profession of babysitters. That's what I do most of the time. I make people feel real good, and I don't do it sarcastic like I'm talking right now. I'm like this. What's your name?
Chantel?
Gosh, Chantel, you know something? I've never worked with anybody more beautiful and talented than you. You are amazing. You're like the best singer I've ever worked with. I'm so honored to be here right now working and producing with you. And man, when you sing, it just, I can't believe how great it makes me feel. Let's get this record. And let's get the best vocal ever. And all I'm doing is making somebody feel comfortable, encouraged, warm, loved. Let them be the best they can be. Ego is okay. Let people, you know, feel great about themselves. As far as how to choose them and what, you have to decide something in advance. Is this a piece of business? Is this an art? Art scares me. Art. I interpret art as something that doesn't have intentions for being commercial. Otherwise, it's a product, and you can be artistic. But you have to decide what your goals are, and it's pretty clear. How are you going to choose to work with somebody? They got some money for you? They got some talent for you? Do they see you? Do they acknowledge you? Do they care about you? Are they selfish? It's about people. Who are you choosing to work with? A lot of times, people really determine their own fate.
I think we only have time for one or two more questions, and I know you had one over here.
It's what I'm doing right now. It's to give to others and to share the knowledge that I've collected on my own. I never had a mentor. So I'm a mentor to every one of you here. Whether you like it or not, I'm teaching y'all something. You don't have to believe me, and you don't have to take my advice. But my purpose is to share the knowledge, the love, the magic, and the wisdom that I have collected. That's my purpose.
I think that is a great question, and a great question to end on, and a great answer to end on over here. I understand there's supposed to be food. I haven't done this before. I'm not sure where it might be. Hopefully we'll find it. Thank you so much. And everybody, please, a round of applause for Peter Rafelson for his time and for his insights.
Thank you all for letting me share with you.
Let's go eat, and we can chat casually out there. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody, for being here.